On this episode of Skeptico, Adam Curry reports on the Society for Scientific Exploration Conference, including an interview with Stephen Browdy.
So I first studied the evidence for large-scale psychokinesis, physical mediumship in particular, and that was a momentous event because the evidence blew me away. What I discovered, first of all, was that the evidence was much cleaner than people made it out to be. It was much more compelling and interesting than people had made it out to be. The usual arguments about the evidence being easily dismissed because of poor observation or poor conditions of observation demonstrated really a lack of command of the evidence. One of the things that struck me was that people were dismissing the non-experimental evidence by appealing to the sleaziest of arguments. They would focus on the weakest pieces of evidence and then generalize from that, which is simply straw man reasoning. The principle on which I've operated all along is that the cases that matter from outside the lab have to be the strongest cases, the ones that are hardest to explain away.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we have an interesting interview with Stephen Browdy coming up, and you just heard a little bit about that. But before we get there, I wanted to mention a couple of things, and the first has to do with this interview. It's the first one we've had where there's actually been someone else who did the interview. Adam Curry, in this case, stepped in, and he's a member of the Society for Scientific Exploration and also has quite an interesting little company trying to apply psi in the real world, and I've provided a link to that in the show notes as well. But I want to draw your attention to the fact that we had someone else do the interview. And in the process of editing this and putting this together, I wanted to mention that, you know, I'd really like to do more of this, and it was really my plan long ago to get other people involved in the Skeptico project and get other folks possibly even to produce these interviews and these shows. So I'd like to reintroduce that topic. If you're a listener to this show and you're interested in these topics and there's someone out there that you'd like to interview, or possibly you're going to a conference and you'd like to interview someone at that conference and you'd like to make that interview available to the Skeptico audience, which is, you know, growing and pretty substantial. You'll reach thousands of people both with the audio version and the transcribed version on the Skeptico website. And more importantly, you'll reach the right people. But we seem to be reaching a lot of folks who are thinking deeply, writing deeply about these topics. So if reaching the Skeptico audience is something that is interesting to you, hey, let's collaborate. It doesn't matter if you're a skeptic or a believer or anything in between. As long as you're interested in talking to the real folks, the people who do the research, the people who are really writing books, thinking about this stuff, writing about this stuff, well then, drop me an email. Let's figure out the best way to approach the topic, and then let's turn you loose. It will certainly allow me to produce more shows and get more interviews out there with the people that you want to hear. I know there's a thread in the forum of potential people to be interviewed on Skeptico, and that list is ever growing faster than I can possibly reach it. So this might be a way to fill in that gap. So think about this. If it sparks an interest, that means you're probably a candidate for being a Skeptico co-producer with me. And fire me an email and let's get going on that. I think that'd really be a fun way to expand what Skeptico does. And the second point I want to talk about before we get into this interview is a little bit of an update on a couple of things that have been going on. First, and I posted this in the forum, but maybe some of you didn't see it. A couple episodes back, I had some, I guess you could call them provocative questions for Dr. Sam Parnia, an NDE researcher in the UK and in the US. Well, Dr. Parnia was nice enough. He did get back to me, and he responded to some of my questions in an email, very intriguing email that I posted in the forum, and I'll provide a link to in these show notes, that really raises more questions than it answers. But the good thing is he's also agreed to come back on sometime in the next couple months when his schedule clears up and talk more in depth about the AWARE study of near-death experience, what he hopes to see from that, and maybe answer some of these questions about whether that experiment really has any chance of succeeding in terms of people actually being able to have a near-death experience, travel outside their body, and see these targets that he's placing up on the ceiling of the hospital room. So that'll be interesting. That'll be coming up in a few months. Couple other updates. Very briefly, Dr. Stephen Novella, many of you know, was on the show. Now it's probably been a couple months ago, had a discussion about near-death experience. Steve said he had some research that he was going to follow up with me on and show me all the backup for the points that he was making or whatever. He wasn't able to do that. I followed up with him a couple times. He did eventually get back to me, and he's always been very good about getting back to me. He's a very busy guy, but he still hasn't sent me any of that stuff. But he says that's forthcoming. I surmise, and you can hear from my broadcast, that what he's really referring to is Susan Black. She's the only person in the skeptical camp that's really published much on this. I've interviewed her before and more recently have invited her several times, begged her to come back on, and gotten no response. So I guess that's not going to happen. If anyone out there knows Ms. Blackmore and has the ability to reach out to her, I think that'd be great. We'd love to have her back on Skeptico and answer some of the questions that are raised. You know, her research, like when Steve mentions it, I mean, if you look at it, it's like 15 years old, the stuff that she's really published. It's quite out of date. So it's frustrating when folks keep bringing it up, and then it's even more frustrating when she doesn't come on and answer the questions about that. But we can't really control that part of it. So unless she comes back on, we'll just have to wait and see if Steve maybe has something else out there that he can pull out of his hat to explain his position. And I'll certainly keep you up to date on that. Another area that Skeptico has looked into in the past is the Global Consciousness Project, of course. And where we left that story was where Dr. Peter Bancel, who's in France, was going to visit Dr. Chris French and his group at Goldsmiths in London. Well, that meeting did take place, and I heard from Dr. Bancel, and apparently they had a good meeting and a kind of meeting of the minds, and it's now up to Chris French's group to see where he goes with that. I'm very glad that that meeting happened, and I'm glad that's going forward, but as you can see from the pace of this, we can't really expect anything to happen very quickly. And moreover, I just can't believe that despite the openness, the seeming openness on the part of Chris French's group, that that's really going to go anywhere. It's just been stalemated for so long. And I just really don't see where it's in their interest to move that project forward very much. It's just too much of a radical shift from where they're at. I'd love to be proven wrong on that, but that's the way it appears to me. At the same time, I want to do everything I can to further that collaboration, further that effort, further that research, because despite how unlikely it is that they'll really collaborate and move forward, it's one of the best chances we have to really develop that kind of collaboration between skeptics and believers. And finally, I wanted to update you on a couple of projects that I've been working on and have mentioned a couple times on the show, mainly these films that I'm working on, which, wow, it's a long story. Films are hard, a lot harder than doing a podcast. It's been a wonderful process for me. I've loved doing it, love being involved, and love the creative part of it, but it's hard. It's hard to get these things out. It's a time sink. It's a money sink. It's a lot of things, but they're coming along, and definitely hope to have one film out this year on near-death experience and look forward to bringing that to all of you. And at the same time, I'm working on my other film, which ties back into the last episode of Skeptico that we had and my interview with Dr. Robert Price. And the title of this film is How Science and Religion Keep Us From Our Spiritual Self. And it explores the interplay between what I call dopey science and dumb religion, and how that keeps us from, well, I have no other way of calling it than our spiritual self. So that's a topic I'm very, very interested in, and one that I want to explore further, both in Skeptico and in the website I'm creating called Our Spiritual Self. So it kind of veers off a little bit from some of the topics we've been talking about, but then again, it uses some of the science from these topics and then injects it into this conversation that's going on between science and religion in order to maybe come to a deeper understanding of what's really going on in that interplay. So that's a project I'm very interested in, and some of those interviews are going to make their way into Skeptico, and you'll hear more about those as they come up. But at the same time, I'm very interested in all the topics that we've talked about, and certainly today's episode, this interview that Adam did with Stephen Browdy, is very much in keeping with the topics that we've talked about here on Skeptico. So stay with me for Adam Curry's interview at the Society for Scientific Exploration Conference with Dr. Stephen Browdy.
So Steve, give me a little capsule about who you are.
I'm a professor and chair of philosophy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Presumably what you want to know is how I got involved in this grubby sci research. The short story is that I started off in philosophy doing work in temporal logic and the philosophy of time, but I'd had a remarkable experience in graduate school watching my own table tilt in the air during an informal seance, which I conveniently put on the back burner and put out of mind until I got a job and got tenure. So I may be crazy, but I'm not stupid. And I knew that some well-known philosophers had taken parapsychological research seriously, and I knew that if I was an honest academic, I needed to come to terms with this and come up with something or other to say about this remarkable experience I'd had. So I read what these philosophers had to say and decided there was, in fact, something worth sinking my teeth into. And then I decided if I was going to do a responsible job of that, I needed to become an insider in the community of academics and scientists who were looking carefully at the evidence. I've done that. And I also decided initially that if I was going to write about this stuff, I needed first to confront the experimental evidence on the assumption that if there was some parapsychological evidence that was going to be clean and capable of convincing the scientific community of the reality of psychic functioning, that it could only be the experimental evidence. And so I did crank out a book on that topic. But I also knew at the same time that there was all this other stuff that had been happening outside the lab from seances and anecdotal reports. And I figured, again, if I was an honest intellect, I at least needed to become acquainted with it before I rejected it summarily. And so I first studied the evidence for large-scale psychokinesis, physical mediumship in particular. And that was a momentous event because the evidence blew me away. What I discovered, first of all, was that the evidence was much cleaner than people made it out to be. It was much more compelling and interesting than people had made it out to be. The usual arguments about the evidence being easily dismissed because of poor observation or poor conditions of observation demonstrated really a lack of command of the evidence. And what I was discovering was that two things. First, I discovered that the people who thought the experimental evidence was the best evidence there was didn't know the non-experimental evidence, and that the experimental evidence had some outstanding flaws which people weren't taking seriously. But first, let me say something about why the non-experimental evidence was so impressive. One of the things that struck me was that people were dismissing the non-experimental evidence by appealing to the sleaziest of arguments. They would focus on the weakest pieces of evidence and then generalize from that, which is simply straw man reasoning. The principle on which I've operated all along is that the cases that matter from outside the lab have to be the strongest cases, the ones that are hardest to explain away. We know that there were cases of fraud, there were cases of poor observation or poor conditions of observation. We can grant all that. Those are not the cases that matter. The cases that are interesting are the ones that in which the conditions of observation were impeccable, the observers were trained, knew what to look for, magicians if that was relevant, and so on. And those cases are much better than most people realize. And so my next goal was to explain what those cases were. As far as the experimental evidence was concerned, I realized first that most of the researchers doing experiments in parapsychology were working in the shadow of J.B. Rhine, and they either knowingly or implicitly adopted certain of his assumptions about what the scientific method was, about the importance of conducting controlled experiments. Rhine had assumed, like many others, that if any evidence would be good, we need to control and manipulate experimental variables, rule out the relevant stuff, and go on from there. The problem is, there's no such thing as a controlled experiment in parapsychology. If you take parapsychology seriously enough to study the evidence for psi, in principle you're studying a phenomenon which, if it exists, can circumvent any experimental controls you might want to impose. So in a psychokinesis or PK experiment, you can't literally do a controlled PK experiment. It's not as if you can go around with a PK meter and try to figure out where the force is coming from before the effect happens. As far as you know, anybody even remotely connected with the experiment could be causally relevant to the final result. It could be the official subject, it could be the experimenter, it could be an onlooker, it could be somebody living in the trunk of an old Studebaker in Gary, Indiana, it could be literally anybody. But researchers working in the standard laboratory tradition are proceeding as though everybody connected with the psi experiment is going to adhere to an idiotic gentleman's agreement that only the official subject will use, only the psi ability being tested for, that nobody else even remotely connected with the experiment will use whatever abilities, psychic abilities, they might have to muddy the experimental waters. And that's completely crazy. There is no way you can do any literally process-oriented work in a standard laboratory situation. To me, the only reasonable way to proceed, given our massive ignorance about the natural history of psychic functioning, is to find psi superstars, people who can more or less reliably produce good results or be associated with good results under a wide variety of conditions with a wide variety of investigators, because only then do you have even a prima facie reason for thinking that these people are causally relevant.
What are some particular case studies that you find most compelling?
What turned me around about all this, well, let me say first of all that I understand that it certainly helps to be initiated personally. It certainly helps if you can see the stuff for yourself. But I think it's irrational to dismiss historical reports just because you can't see it for yourself. I mean, there are lots of reasons for taking eyewitness testimony seriously. Let me back up before I give you a good case or two. One standard reason for dismissing eyewitness accounts in these cases is a very bad argument. Let's call it the argument from human bias. What people often say is that witnesses of these events outside strict laboratory conditions are simply biased or predisposed to see the miraculous or to see what they want. The problem is biases cut two ways, against reports by the credulous and also against reports by the incredulous. So if we're going to dismiss reports that psychic phenomena occurred because people might be biased in favor of those phenomena, then we have to be equally skeptical of reports that phenomena didn't occur when they're being issued by skeptics. We can't assume that one is inherently more reliable than the other. And although a lot of attention gets paid to the careless reports of some enthusiasts for psi phenomena, the history of psychical research has plenty of examples of dishonest or unreliable reports by skeptics that phenomena didn't occur. I can't go into all of those now. If you'll permit me a sleazy plug for one of my books, I recommend looking at the Limits of Influence, where I outline what some of those are. Okay, having said that, I should also mention that, just as a matter of fact, in the best cases, and remember, the best cases are the ones that count, in the best cases, the witnesses of some of these remarkable large-scale physical phenomena were not only not biased in favor of the phenomena, they were biased against it. That's one of the reasons these cases are so good. These are cases which converted skeptical investigators who might have been magicians, prepared to debunk the medium or whatever it might have been, and there are plenty of examples of those, too. So, an example of a really good case. One of my favorite historical cases is of the medium D.D. Hume, H-O-M-E. This was a late 19th century case. Hume was apparently a very gifted medium. His mediumship lasted about 25 years. He was never caught cheating. He would conduct seances at the spur of the moment in locations never before visited. So you can't say that the phenomena that occurred when he walked into a room for the first time were produced by some hidden apparatus or because he concealed a confederate, for instance. And there are plenty of these reports. Hume would enter a room for the first time and the bookshelf at the other end of the room would walk toward the people who just entered the room. Hume was investigated by, among others, the chemist and physicist William Crookes. And Crookes conducted some really nifty experiments with Hume. One of Hume's standard phenomena was to make an accordion play melodies on request, sometimes untouched, allegedly floating around the room, and sometimes held at the end away from the keys. So a performance would have been impossible. Now, I realize that sounds really bizarre, but bear with me. Hume also thought that the phenomena were strongest under the seance table. Now, granted, that's something that, under certain circumstances, could sound suspicious. And Crookes realized that, but he was a clever investigator, and he realized that if that's what Hume sincerely believed, then it's not a wise procedure experimentally to force Hume more than necessary out of his comfort zone. So try to find some way of testing the phenomena under conditions that Hume found congenial. So here's what he did. First of all, he bought a new accordion. So there could be no question that this was not one of Hume's props. He went to Hume's apartment and watched him change clothes, so he could determine that Hume wasn't concealing some device on his body that would have made the accordion play. And I remind you, this was 1871. It's not clear what kind of miniaturized device this could possibly have been. Then he took Hume to his house, where he had constructed a cage made out of wire and wood that just fit under his dining room table. There was room for Hume to get his hand under the tabletop and into the cage to hold the accordion at the end away from the keys. There wasn't enough room for Hume to get his hand into the cage to manipulate the accordion any further. It's too bad you can't see all the helpful hand gestures I'm making here. There were 9 people present, 2 seated on each side of Hume, and to make sure he wasn't taking his feet out of his boots, another observer was stationed under the table with a lamp, and under those conditions, the accordion was seen to move in and out, keys were depressed, sounds came out of the accordion. At that point, Crookes asked Hume to take his hand out of the cage, put both hands on the table. An electrical current was run through the cage. The accordion was still seen to flop around inside the cage. Now, I think that's one of the most important experiments in the history of parapsychology. No magician has ever tried to duplicate that under conditions even approaching those that Crookes imposed, and I think for good reason. They just can't.
How about you tell us a little about the SSC and JSC and what you've done, and a little about how your understanding of classical parapsychological phenomena has affected your thinking about other types of unusual phenomena.
Look, one of the striking facts for me about the history of science is that human beings have proven themselves to be pretty crappy judges of the empirically possible. Time and again, we've been told that certain phenomena simply can't occur, and then we find out that, whoops, they can. So I have very little patience with people who tell us that some of the anomalies studied by members of the Society for Scientific Exploration are simply impossible. I think we need something a little more compelling than their a priori assurance of that. The SSE is an organization devoted to the study of anomalies of all kinds in a number of different areas of science. It could have to do with parapsychology, it could do with cryptozoology, it might have to do with UFOs, it could be some other anomalous physical phenomena, it could have to do with some of the strange psychological anomalies, for example, having to do with hypnosis and other altered states. There's a lot we don't know, and it's almost unimaginable hubris to think that we've exhausted nature's secrets at this stage in history. It's also unimaginable hubris to me to suppose that nature must reveal its secrets in those forms that we prefer at the moment. I think we need to be methodologically diverse. I think we need to remember a lesson from Aristotle, and that is that different domains require different modes of investigation. And there's no reason to think that all secrets of nature will reveal themselves according to the methods preferred in a few of the physical sciences.
And what is the Journal of Scientific Exploration?
The Journal of Scientific Exploration is the official scholarly publication of the Society for Scientific Exploration. It comes out quarterly. We try to publish articles in a number of areas of frontier science or anomalistics. They could be about physics or chemistry. We recently did an entire issue on LENR, or so-called cold fusion. We often have special issues on other topics. We've got one coming up on mediumship, approaching that topic from a variety of angles. Traditionally, the JSC publishes papers on all of the areas of anomalistics that I just mentioned. There have been articles on cryptozoology, on UFOs, on remote viewing, on energy science, for example.
I assume that the big debate in mediumship or parapsychology is whether or not it's a kind of macro PK, or if it is something from some other dimension or some spirit world.
There are basically two kinds of mediumship. There's mental mediumship, in which mediums or channels relay information of one kind or another, ostensibly from the deceased. And there's another kind of mediumship called physical mediumship, which originally spiritualists thought provided another kind of evidence of postmortem persistence, but which today more people, I think, would regard as a kind of example of psychokinesis by the living. But the big question about any form of mediumship is whether what we're seeing is evidence of postmortem existence of some kind or other, or whether we're just seeing very interesting kinds of productions, psychic productions by the living, that may on occasion simulate evidence of postmortem survival. I had to write, I mean, I don't know about other people, I write books to figure out what my views are, because only when I've started working out these things in detail do I start to really get clear on the issues myself. So I figured when I was sufficiently chronologically challenged, I was going to write a book on the evidence for postmortem survival. And I did. I wrote a book called Immortal Remains. And my goal in writing it was to see if I could figure out how to resolve the question, are we dealing with psychic functioning among the living, or are we dealing with survival? And I ended up still being on the fence. I mean, I came away with an enhanced appreciation of just how remarkable living human beings are. I think one of the things I came to appreciate was that we don't really know just what the limits of living human functioning are. We need to look at people who do extraordinary things under sometimes usual but sometimes extraordinary circumstances. We need to look at extreme forms of human functioning. We need to look at prodigies. We need to look at savants. Savants are particularly important because they show remarkable abilities which you wouldn't expect given their other obvious cognitive deficits. So you've got calculating savants, for example, who can factor any number you give to them but who can't add the change in their pocket. There are musical savants who are spastic until they sit down to play the piano. And this is important because sometimes the evidence for survival is evidence of people who ostensibly haven't learned the appropriate skills, but who in a mediumistic context seem to demonstrate those skills. And the fact is, we don't know what people are thoroughly capable of under various kinds of altered or unusual states, like dissociative states. And some of the most intriguing bits of evidence relevant to the issue of survival I have found to be cases that provide no real evidence of survival, but seem to show a kind of combination of, let's say, dissociation plus latent gifted functioning, whether it's literary functioning or linguistic functioning or whatever it might be. And some of those cases are really revealing. And one of the things I came to understand from that is that we really don't even have a firm grasp of what human abilities are. And until we really start trying to get a grip on what human abilities are, what the limits of human abilities are, what savants and prodigies are, and so on, I don't think we're in a position to really answer conclusively whether we've got good evidence for survival, however nifty the cases may be. And some of them are admittedly very nifty.
Who's doing the most interesting work right now? In the most promising to you in, let's say, in the field of mediumship or survival or consciousness or PK?
I'm not sure how to answer the question, who's doing the best work right now. I mean, in my own case, I'm interested in pursuing certain spiritualist or spiritist sitter groups that are producing large-scale classic spiritualist seance phenomena, including table movements, floating objects, the production of ectoplasm or various kinds of gooey substances emerging from the medium's orifice. As grisly and weird and distasteful as that might sound, I think that's where the action is. And we have ways of studying this now today that we never had during the heyday of the spiritualist movement at the end of the 19th century. So I've been trying to study some of these phenomena with high-definition infrared video camcorders. And although my results, I'm not prepared really to talk about the results yet, I think that's the way to go. And to my knowledge, there aren't a lot of people or anybody beside myself right now who's doing that.
Thanks again to Dr. Brody for joining us today on Skeptico, and of course, thanks to Adam for doing the interview. If you'd like more information about Dr. Brody or information about Adam Curry, please visit the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. You'll also find links to our previous shows, a forum link, an email link to me, all the good stuff that you'll need. Have some interesting interviews coming up. I mentioned a while back that I have an interview with Gary Habermas, which is kind of a bookend in some way to the interview with Robert Price. Gary Habermas is a very well-known Christian apologist and has also done a fair amount of research into near-death experience. So it's a very, very interesting interview, something I really enjoyed doing, and I enjoyed talking to Dr. Habermas, who I genuinely like and respect, even though I can't really completely understand where he's coming from, but you'll hear more about that if you tune into the next episode of Skeptico. So that's going to do it for today. Take care. Let me hear from you. Tell other folks about Skeptico, and bye for now.